Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I'm at that stage in life when I'm close to doing a big clean out. Not that I've started yet, but I'm what you might call building up to it. My friends and I chat about it all the time. "Your children will toss the lot in a skip when you're gone," one says. "Better to save them the trouble." "Do what Marie Kondo advises," says another. "If it doesn't spark joy, let it go." I peered into the cupboard under the stairs. It was chock-a-block with discarded raincoats, old winter boots and warped tennis rackets. What a great place to start. What joy there'd be in clearing this lot out. With determination, I reached for the small suitcase that had been taking up space at the back of this cupboard for years. I brushed the dust off it with a damp cloth and sprang open the clasps, the right-hand one needing that special knack that only members of my family are familiar with. Inside, remnants of dressmaking fabric lay in neat piles, as bright and vibrant as the day my mother placed them there. I could feel her presence as my hand folded back the layers. Red chiffon, emerald green satin, muslin, calico, organza. Each fabric reminded me of a wedding, a christening, a special dress dance, a school play. There was the pink gingham of my older sister's summer dress, and underneath, the younger one's polka dot shorts. And look, the purple crimpling from my catsuit, copied from Emma Peel of The Avengers. The red and blue striped cotton curtains in the back bedroom. The velvet of the cushion covers on the fireside chairs. The gabardine for the boys' short trousers. The lace from our communion dresses. And this? Could it be the poplin she used to make dresses for our cousins the summer they came to stay when their mother was ill? And further down, a tiny scrap of lemon seersucker from my brother's romper suit, reminding me of the golden brown baby he was, and he now 64 years old. At the bottom of the suitcase lay my mother's brown paper patterns, folded neatly in a bundle. She could make anything from these patterns, and did, for all sorts of people. All you had to do was turn up at our house with an idea for an outfit in your head, a few yards of material under your arm, and within days you'd be back for a fitting, standing precariously on a dining room chair and eyeing yourself in the mirror above the mantelpiece. She would pin and tuck you and ask you to point to that part of your knee where you wanted the hem turned. "Are you sure you want it that long?" she'd caution. "It's the 60s, you know. Hems are on the rise." She worked best under pressure, and we learnt early on not to panic. My Deb's dress was cut out on the morning of the dance itself. I had a fitting at lunchtime, and she was serenely taking up the hem, even while the unwitting boy was knocking on the door outside, an orchid in one hand, a box of chocolates in the other. But it was all hands on deck when the pressure was on. She'd be at the Singer sewing machine all day, her feet peddling like billio, the cigarette butts lining up beside her, the thread cuttings building up on the floor, so that weeks later we'd still be pulling them from the dog's coat. "Oh, silly dog, look what's got tangled up in your coat." The cat, too sophisticated to participate, would watch the action from the kitchen windowsill, wondering perhaps if anyone was going to get fed in our house that day. Stray children would be urged, "Peel a few potatoes, will you, and make a bit of gravy for the chicken while you're at it." But she always came up trumps, my mother. People tell me all the time now, "Your mother made my wedding dress and all my bridesmaids. The fun we had at the fittings. She was a fantastic dressmaker, your mother." And so I sat with the remnants of our dressmaking days laid out before me. All our lives were there, and like a box of old photos, they triggered memories I thought I'd long since forgotten. But what to do with them all? Did this old suitcase of remnants spark joy? Yes, it did, a thousandfold. Maybe it was time to think about all this clearing out business another day. I folded the fabrics back inside the suitcase, closed the lid down, slipped the clasps into place, the right needing that little knack that my mother taught us so well. I took the suitcase back into its place at the back of the cupboard, where it could stay for as long as it wanted.
Dear sweet sewing machine, I will promise to love, honor, and keep you polished and clean.
Oil,
grease,
all you can eat if you will turn my satin and silk into sugar and salt,
butter and milk,
and maybe a toy, a baby.
If you listen to the radio in the early hours of the morning, you often hear nostalgic tunes from the 60s and 70s, music that has long dropped off the regular daytime playlists. I was heading to Dublin Airport with my family for a week's holiday. It was 5 o'clock in the morning and the man on the graveyard shift was playing songs that were more aimed at my parents' generation rather than mine or my children's. Still, it was a nice, gentle way to ease into the morning. As my own family snoozed around me, I tried to focus on the red taillights ahead of me to stay awake. Then the first few bars of a very familiar tune played. I travelled through the airwaves back to my parents' house in Clonmel. Joe Cuddy closed his eyes, drew back the curtains, and I smiled as I thought of our mother and her attempts to learn the lyrics of that song. As I drove, I tried to remember the sound of my mother's singing voice. I couldn't say for certain if she was a great singer, but she always sang with great emotion, especially when she found the right song. She was often asked to sing at parties or any kind of a sing-song, and there seemed to be plenty of those when we were growing up. Between weddings and funerals and people just coming back to our house after closing time, 46 Hayward Road was a bit of a magnet for people who didn't want to go home. My father always felt that if the crack was good, then it should be kept going. From our bedrooms, we could hear muffled singing coming through the floor. Owl lads with hardly a note in their head belted out rebel songs and camellias. Then we'd hear a bit of hush and someone encouraging our mother to sing. Come on now, Breda. Breda Whalen for a song. Whisht up, Letchy. She wouldn't take too much persuading. Then, through thin floorboards, we'd hear songs like James Connolly or Gentle Mother. Or if the mood was lively, The Last Thing on My Mind. When she'd finish, the floorboards would vibrate as the room below would erupt in applause and cheers. Go on, fair play, Breda. Long before my older brothers introduced us to the music of Slade, Bowie and T-Rex, we just listened to whatever our mother liked. We were brought up to the sounds of everyone from Johnny Cash to Philomena Begley, Joseph Locke to Big Tom. And there was great comfort and warmth in all these songs, and her music became our music. Our mother was always trying to expand her repertoire. She'd hear another of her favourite songs on the radio and try and jot down the lyrics as quickly as they were being sung. When my brother bought a Ferguson tape recorder, it revolutionised her song learning. She could now tape songs off the radio and stop and start her recording wherever she needed. When Joe Cuddy went to number one in Ireland in 1974 with Any Dream Will Do, she just had to learn it. She especially liked the backing arrangement, which featured some children echoing Joe Cuddy's words back to him. Mam, who was now getting more familiar with the Ferguson tape recorder, used to record herself singing to help her learn the lyrics. Unfortunately for us, for this song, she insisted on having her own backing singers too. So myself and my sister Jacqueline were conscripted, along with our baby sister Catherine, for extra harmonics. Mam took her recording session seriously, and she put us through many takes in order to get the perfect recording. We were able to echo her when she sang I Closed My Eyes, but we had great difficulty in perfecting the aww that followed the line drew back the curtains. She taped and overdubbed and we awed in growing desperation until she finally had a recording that was acceptable. I never chose to listen to the recording afterwards. I can't even remember Mammy singing that song again at any session. What I do remember is that our older brother Liam found the tape and could not believe his ears. This was comedy gold for him, and he made the most of it. He even recorded his own spoof version, singing our mother's part and completely exaggerating our aws. He tormented us with it for years, so much so that we grew to hate the song and cringed every time we heard it afterwards. That was until now. A lot of musical notes have flowed under the bridge in the almost 50 years since we made our infamous recording. As my wife and adult children slept, I reached down and turned up the volume on the radio, just enough to drown out my singing, as I quietly awed to Joe Cuddy and the memory of our mother once again.
I closed my eyes, drew back the curtain to see for certain what I thought I knew. Far, far away, someone was weeping.
On the 22nd of June 1930, 14-year-old Gerald Lakin sent a postcard from Eton College to his family's parlour maid in Ireland. "Please send me a pair of long flannel trousers," he wrote. Over 90 years later, I'm holding the card in my hand. The handwriting is the elegant cursive of the time, and the underlining of the words long and flannel gives an air of urgency to the message. The long trousers were to be sent care of his housemaster, J.C. Batterwick, Esquire, as soon as possible. And I can only surmise that cricket season was approaching, or that the boy was hoping to go boating and needed to appear in attire befitting a young gentleman. I found the postcard recently in a tin box at the back of my mother's wardrobe. The box belonged to my late grandmother, Annie Keating, and as well as Gerald Lakin's postcard, there were yellowed and crumbling newspaper clippings, postcards arranging barn dances, some holy pictures, and a photo of Granny with 1925 Hortown House scribbled on the back. Annie was born into a family of 16 in 1906. She left school at the age of 12, and through her teens, she worked in the kitchens of various farmhouses and big houses. When she was 19, she landed her dream job as house parlour maid in Hortown House, County Wexford. The photo in the box shows her on the steps of the big house, smiling like a film star, her curls cropped into the fashionable bobbed style of the time. Hortown House was owned by the Lakin family. Major Michael Lakin, known as Toby, was a veteran of the Boer War and World War I. His wife Kathleen was a Fitzgerald from the family who owned Johnstown Castle. My grandmother loved her time in Hortown. She idolised Kathleen Lakin and was very fond of the Major, who was exceptionally generous to his staff. For her 21st birthday, the Major presented Annie with a pet lamb. "You rear it and I'll sell it for you," he told her. The Lakins had two little boys, always referred to as Master Gerald and Master Vic, when Granny told us about them in her old age. "They were like chalk and cheese," she said. "Master Gerald was outgoing and friendly, while Master Vic was quiet and shy." The good times at Hortown House came to an end on the 21st of February 1930, when Kathleen Lakin was thrown from her horse at the hunt. That afternoon, Annie, anticipating the return of the hunt, had heated the water for her mistress's bath, laid out her towels and talcum powder, and pressed the blue evening dress that Mrs. Lakin would wear for dinner that evening. She listened for the sound of hooves on the avenue, which would be the signal for her to carry out cups of soup to the hunters. But instead, she heard a motor car draw up. The knocker fell ominously on the front door. Moments later, there was a cry of distress. The Major had just been informed that his wife had been seriously injured. By evening, the household was plunged into despair. News was relayed that the mistress was not expected to live. Next day, the Major arranged for the maids to be brought to Wexford Hospital to see Mrs. Lakin for the last time. One by one, the women approached the heavily bandaged figure in the bed. Remembering how she herself might have died from pleurisy the previous winter, only that the Lakins had paid for a private nurse to look after her, Annie took Mrs. Lakin's hand, leaned down, and whispered something tender to her. She never told me what her words to her mistress were, but she was rewarded with a gentle smile as the dying woman squeezed her hand.
In keeping with the tradition of the time, Kathleen's sons, Victor and Gerald, he of the flannel trousers, were not informed of their mother's death until a full week later, when their father travelled to their boarding school in England to break the news and bring them home. Annie was in the kitchen when the major's car arrived back. The front door was flung open, and the two distraught boys burst into the hall. 50 years later, Granny still wept as she remembered the cries of "Mama, Mama," echoing through the house as the heartbroken children raced up the stairs to their mother's room. Within a short time, the boys returned to Eton, and life in Horetown continued without the beloved mistress of the house. The major threw himself into memorialising his late wife, and in less than 2 years, a new maternity wing bearing her name opened at Wexford Hospital. Like their father and uncle before them, Gerald and Victor Lakin's destiny lay in the military. They both served in North Africa with the 16th 5th Lancers in World War II. Victor was badly wounded but survived the war. Gerald died in battle in Tunisia, and he was buried there in February 1943. Now I'm thinking of the 14-year-old boy with less than half his life left before him, grief-stricken and lonely on a long midsummer evening as he sat in the study hall writing a postcard to his late mother's maid, signing off with a cheery sounding, "Hoping you and everyone are very well," before addressing it to Miss Annie Keating, Horetown House, County Wexford, Ireland, in ink that has faded little in over 90 years.
My grandmother and my Aunt Angela had this happy little ritual that they observed every Friday lunchtime. Granny would buy fresh cod from the fish stall on Lower George's Street in Dunleary, and Angela would arrive with two singles from the chipper opposite the shrine to Our Lady on Oliver Plunkett Road. And they'd sit in Granny's kitchen and they'd eat this fish and chips and catch up on the news, which increasingly, with the passing of years, centred on who had featured in the obituary columns in the past 7 days and who was likely to make it in there next. One December Friday, Angela arrived with the Christmas cake she'd made for her. It was something she did every year. But Granny told her to give it to the neighbours. "I won't be needing it," she said. "I'm going to be jigging in heaven on Christmas Day." Which struck Angela as odd, since Christmas Day was only 3 weeks away and Granny wasn't suffering from anything terminal. But she talked about her death like it was something she was scheduling in, like a dental appointment or a trip to the hairdresser. Much to the family's embarrassment, she started to tell everyone, neighbours, friends, even her solicitor, about her plans for Christmas Day. She'd rhyme off a list of people, all long dead, with whom she was going to be spending the festive season. Granny was a formidable woman from a generation of formidable women, Annie Kehoe, from Wexford Town. She raised 7 children, a son and 6 daughters, in a small 3-bedroom house in Monkstown Farm. She did it while holding down a full-time job and with a husband who was bedridden for years with tuberculosis. She looked how a granny is supposed to look, which is to say, she had that dandelion puffball hair that all of our grannies had in the 1980s. And she had some wonderful eccentricities. She couldn't bear to see people kissing on television, for instance. And when she came to our house every Sunday, she would take charge of the remote control for the Coronation Street omnibus. And if 2 people even looked like they were about to lock lips, she would switch over to the snooker and we'd watch 5 minutes of Jimmy White against Bill Werbenyuk before she decided that enough time had passed for Sally Webster to finish whatever she was doing with Kevin. She had this instinctive love for the underdog. One night she went to a meeting of the local residents' association, called to discuss the problem of crows nesting in the trees and disturbing everyone's sleep. She brought the hall to stunned silence by saying, "Why don't we just leave them alone? Aren't they human beings like the rest of us?" Close to the end of her life, a neighbour happened to upset her with a careless remark, and I told her she might find it therapeutic the next time she met this woman to tell her to F off. She said she'd never used the F word in her life, and I thought that was a terrible shame to reach the age of 90 and to have never known the feeling of empowerment that comes with dropping the F bomb on the right person at the right time. So I put 50 euros on the table and I told her it was hers if she would only say it. She shook her head. My brothers started adding money to the pile until there was close to 300 euros in the kitty. And then, from the mouth of this sweet, grey-haired old lady whom we loved, poured forth a volley of expletives so colourful and so imaginative that it would have made Joe Pesci take a backward step. When she'd finished, she scooped up the money and put it in her handbag like she'd just beaten the house at Caesar's. The next day, she stepped out into the garden and heard her neighbour shout, "Morning, Mrs. Kyo!" And she started to think about what she might say in reply. And she was taken by a fit of giggles so violent that she had to go back inside. That was her final summer. Her only son, Peter, died that September, 8 years after she buried her eldest daughter, Maura. A couple of weeks later, she suffered a mild stroke, and while she was recovering, she told my mother that she didn't want to live long enough to see any more of her children die. I think that was part of her resolve to leave the world behind and to do it on the day of her choosing, for her, the holiest day of the year. 6 days before Christmas, she complained of feeling unwell and was taken by ambulance to St. Michael's Hospital in Dunleary. A doctor who examined her asked her what the problem was, and she told him matter-of-factly and with rock-solid certainty, "There's no problem. I'm on my way to heaven, and this is just the first step of the journey." The life began to slowly ebb from her over the following days. On Christmas morning, just after 10 o'clock, she woke up from one of her increasingly long sleeps. Angela, who was with her, said later she had this excited look in her eyes, like a child discovering that they got the Christmas gift they wanted. And she said, "I'm going now." And then she did. 20 Christmases ago, Annie Kehoe, my grandmother, a woman who taught me that it's not a bad return on your life to say that you worked hard and you carried your own weight and you left the world a little bit happier than you found it.
Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready for the time of your life? It's time to stand up and fight. It's all right, it's all right. Hand in hand, we'll take a caravan to the
moon. She came into the world early, impatient, raring to go. It was a fittingly dramatic affair. Her dad was due to be on stage that evening. Twice that evening, to be precise, in Galway, on the opposite coast. We'd later learned that the gang waited in the pub from the afternoon on for an update on her, causing trouble before she even got here. I was on the massage table in the salon when I finally accepted what was happening. I was too polite to interrupt her work, despite the growing pain and the diminishing time between contractions, because yes, Claire, that's what that is. You are in labour. I still paid for my massage, mind. I could hear the disbelief in my husband's voice. "Okay, call your sister, call the midwife, then call me back." The contractions were 2.5 minutes apart now, and they were definitely real. By the time I got to the back of my sister's car, who had gotten to me in record time, I thought she'd be born there. He was on his way. The company knew and the shows would be cancelled, and boy, would I be in trouble if this was a false alarm. But she was coming. and she seemed in quite the hurry. Maternity hospital staff are calm angels. Nothing fazes them. He is through Enfield, flooring it, no doubt. My sister told him to put his hazards on and drive in the hard shoulder. The midwife told me not to be holding on for Dad now. This baby was coming and I was to tell her if I needed to push. They didn't think he'd make it. He arrived just as the pain relief kicked in. He was the real relief. We put on Christmas FM and all was calm. I pushed and pushed and pushed. The doctor thought I'd need help, but my angel midwife, real life angels they are, she thought I could do it. She asked for a couple more minutes, and she was right. And she was here. And immediately, I knew her. Till that very moment, the whole thing had been so abstract. Yes, I could feel her moving around in there. Yes, we'd bought the bits and pieces and done the online classes, and in theory, I knew she was coming. But in that moment, I knew her. I recognised her presence. She felt so very familiar to me. I've yet to find the words to describe the wave that came over me. Not love, as people say, but I felt certain. Sure, she was ours, and that although I didn't know what I was doing yet, I'd figure it out. Utter calm. But she was little, so she had to go. Away from me, but he could go, but I had to go to surgery, complications. I had to go away from her. And is that completely necessary? Yes, okay, whatever she needs. He got to go with her, and I was glad at that. And when I got out of theatre, he got to come back to me, but then neither of us were with her, and no one was with the dog, and my blood pressure, and where are her clothes, and when can I see her again, and can I get that tea and toast now that everyone goes on about? And I have a picture of him with it, you know, the tea and toast and the moustache that he had for the show. And an angel nurse told me I could see her once I could walk again, I should sleep a little, and she would come and get me at 5 a.m. on the dot. And she did, and she brought me to her, and there she was. Toasty and warm and tiny and mine. She got to come back to me soon after, and I don't remember what we did exactly, but I didn't sleep for days. I sat watching her because I was so tired that if I slept, maybe I wouldn't hear her, and the less I slept, the more tired I got, so the riskier it was to sleep, and so I just didn't for about 8 months. Her name is Ada Sue.
Photos of my mother. Photo album of a life that flicks open. Mother, aged 12, standing on a large kitchen colander painted white in a school hall. The nuns have put you there, long curls rolling down to your shoulders, your hands pressed in prayer, a halo of stars over your head. Feast of the Assumption, and you've been chosen to ascend to heaven with your angelic face. Years later, in New York, after a poetry reading, I start chatting to an older Irish woman in her 70s. She tells me she's lived for nearly 50 years in America, but even so, her Cork accent is still prominent. "You sound just like my mother," I say. "There's this photo of her. You know, I always thought it was funny. She had to pretend to be Mary in her school and stand there for hours." I continue to describe the photo in detail until she grips my arm, asks your name. "I can't believe it. I have that exact photo. I went to the same school. I was your mother's replacement when she got tired." "Mother, you are astonished when I get off the flight, bearing this story as a gift." We find the photo again and laugh at your expression. So composed, so holy. "Yes, I was a great little actress, but after that I cut my hair short, got myself a pair of scissors and chopped away. Your granny was horrified, but I didn't want to be Mary ever again. I wanted to be young. I wanted to be modern." Mother in a white shirt, wide belt and colourful skirt, all stolen from your sister. It's your first dance with my father. His hand is tight around your tiny waist. Your face is radiant with being in love. You took my shirt without asking, your sister's fury. I'm locking that wardrobe door and keeping the key. Mother on a day trip, a beach in Crosshaven. You sit on Dad's raincoat, your nose nuzzled into his. You're 18. I won't allow you to marry until you're 21, your father warns. You are his youngest, and he never wants you to go, can't bear the thought of it. When you eventually do leave for your honeymoon, he is full of such sorrow after the wedding breakfast that he hangs his head, says to his wife and your older sister, "Well, 'tis aisy counting us now." The women suppress giggles, then laugh out loud, but their playful mocking of him can't console him. He's lost his youngest daughter, lost you. Gathered at Kent Station, Cork, your father and mother and sister all crying. You're moving to Dublin to live, to start your married life. But it's 1960s Ireland and it may as well be Australia you're going to. Why would anyone leave Cork for Dublin? I mean to say, haven't we everything here, girl? Your parents are perplexed, bereft, and you're sad for them but excited all at once. Freedom is a basement flat in an old house on Palmerstown Road, your own front door. Freedom is an old carpet to roll back and find oak floors underneath. Ignore the mean landlord berating you, threatening to increase your rent for defiling his flat. Polish those magnificent floors. See, your future is shining there. Mother, photographed coming over O'Connell Bridge, one arm linked around my father, the other holding something. What is it? What are you carrying, Mum? A pound of grass seed for our first house, and Bertrand Russell's A History of Western Philosophy as a present for your father. The camera clicks. The street photographer is paid. Your first child twitches inside of you. My older brother, a honeymoon baby. Mother, free and young, the sun on your face, the wind in your dark curls. You stand on a rock in white shorts and a sleeveless shirt, your long arms open wide, welcoming what will come. Your right hand lets flow in the wind a silk scarf that is as exuberant as you are. For months after your death, I face this photo outwards on the windowsill of my front room. The postman, neighbours, friends, all comment on your loveliness. But the sun is harsh, begins to fade your features, and I turn you inwards to me, to privacy. You're this small photo on my desk now. I thumb the dust away, search in your face for mine, whisper, "Mother, where are you now?" You are kneeling forever at our house, your arms stretched, assured as branches, wide as the world that you will save me from. I am 3 years old, and you gather me close to you, the ring on your finger glinting with love. This last picture forever with me before the album closes.
On this morning's programme we heard Remnants by Maeve Edwards. Breda for a Song was by Joe Whelan. Postcard to Annie by A.M. Cousins. Jigging in Heaven was by Paul Howard. Ada Sue by Claire Munley. And Photos of My Mother by Enda Wiley. The music was My Dear Sweet Sewing Machine, sung by Adam Cantor and Alexandra Silber from the 2016 Broadway cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. Any Dream Will Do, sung by Joe Cuddy. Scythe, composed and played on piano by Conor Lenihan. Caravan of Love by the House Martins. And Shabó Mullanov by Catriona O'Leary and Dhulra. And a new play you may be interested in, The Hare, co-written by Claire Munley and Bob Kelly, is on in the Axis in Ballymun this Tuesday. That's the 12th of March. And it continues on to Limerick, Waterford and many other destinations on its national tour. See onceoffproductions.com for more details. And Claire's essay, Ada Sue, is included in the best-selling anthology from this programme. Sunday Miscellany, a selection from 2018 to 2023, which is in bookshops now. The publisher is New Island Books. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can find more from this and other RTE arts and culture programmes on rte.ie/culture. And to listen back to this morning's programme, go to the RTE radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.